Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. DebatePhysics.com also, but debate requires some sort of disciplined interaction where statements by one person are refuted or countered by another person, and then there's a counter argument and all that kind of process, and it isn't just some sort of, you know, name calling and bullshit. But anyway. So we can't really find a debater for any of these concepts. Alright, so I'm back on the Preston Becker video. And yes, it's getting into the vectors, the pointing vector. Pointing. Not pointing, but pointing. Anyway, where's my damn pen? Okay, here's one. Alright, it's probably going to run out soon. It's kind of a messy subject, so I guess I'll just go through my understanding of the elements, what the relevant bits are, and why I don't think it's being appropriately applied to the idea of induction. Induction is a two-dimensional kind of argument versus the three-dimensional argument that the pointing vector really gets to. I mean, it's the idea you have something going this way and you have something going this way, and then your thumb points in the other direction, right? So it's really just pointing out that there's three physical dimensions to space, and the fact is if two dimensions are doing a certain thing, the third dimension only has one choice but to do something compliant to the other two, what the other two are doing. It's a subtle argument like that is my argument. Okay, that's my hypothesis. Okay, that it's not coincidental, okay, that the pointing vector has these three elements in it, three dimensional elements. And if you understand that the dimensions are planar, that is, two of the dimensions are always in the same plane, and the third dimension is outside of that plane. So if I turn my hand this way, my middle finger and my thumb are on the same plane, and this one's the odd guy out. And if I turn my fingers this way, then which these two are on the same plane, okay, and this one's the odd guy out, right? And if I turn it a third way, then the other finger's the odd guy out. So that's the interesting thing about dimensions. And so that's what the pointing vector is really about, is the dimensions that you've changed something. So you've changed it in one dimension, that affects the other dimension. So if I had an object and I squished it in this dimension, I made it thinner. Well, the implication would be is that it might lengthen in this dimension and it might squish out in this dimension, right? So the consequence would be a change in the other two dimensions. That's sort of what we're going to get to. But I'm going to skip over a bunch of this and we'll just do the beginning of it. So anyway.
Starting point, three equations. The first equation is Faraday's law of induction. But in the circuits that we will be...
Okay, so then this gets into the motor force. All right. And so there's... I'll do the dimensional arguments and we'll just leave it at that. And you can make your own... You know, you can do it the way what you wish. Because I haven't... there's a catch to it. There's a reason why there's a right-hand rule. The fact is, they don't have an explanation why it is, an elemental explanation, and I don't have one completely either, completely. I think I'm getting close with this three-dimensional thing. I just haven't gotten it all figured out yet. But I think induction is simpler, because it's really just saying you run... So we have the idea of the two wires, and the simple argument I'm going to make here, okay, is that this isn't that complicated. When you're running current through the wire this way, all right, you are sending a force radially around the wire, okay, because you are changing the atoms. So you're making the atoms fat and thin, let's just say, okay, so you're basically changing the surface of the wire. So you could just think of it as you're making the wire fatter, or you make the wire thinner by how many electrons are in it. So with that simple analogy, you can understand the outside of the wire is moving. And every time it moves, every time it pushes forward, it pushes extra force because it makes a bunch of reflections sooner. And when it goes backwards, it makes less force to the other guy because a bunch of reflections happen later, slower, less reflections, factually. There's actually less of them, and they're delayed, okay, in getting there. And that's what you're sending to the other wire, and it's just sympathetically doing whatever you're doing here. So if this is if you're pumping current through the wire, okay, increasing the number of electrons, and so that would mean you have a more negative over here and positive over here. Okay, it's backwards, but you're stuck with that. You're essentially doing the same thing to the wire over here. So if this one's pressurized, that is, it's got fat, it's pressurizing this wire. Okay, that is, it's pushing more pressure into this wire, which is going to cause it to do exactly the sympathetic same thing, in the sense that you're going to compress this wire, which is, you're going to create a voltage in the wire, because you're going to basically create the same circumstance. You're going to make the pressure that's here, you're going to make this sympathetically feel that pressure. And so even though it's going to look opposite, you know, it's going to be smaller space, it's going to be high pressure inside the wire, which is the important part. So you're pressurizing this wire, and you're basically going to end up creating a sympathetic electricity, in the sense that this will be negative, all right, because you've pressurized it with this negative, right? Ignore this positive, because we're just saying that this section of the wire is 5 volts, okay? So it's got extra electrons, and, you know, 5 volts worth. It's fatter because of the extra pressure. That's going to cause a signal sent to the other wire that's going to pressurize it. It's just going to become negative. And it's going to be negative relative to this side of the wire and this side of the wire. So it's basically going to send that high pressure in both of these directions. It's not going to be a simple dipole. It's going to be a more complex pole, in the sense that the electricity is going to go both ways, because there is no high pressure here. You know, because you had a switch and you opened it. This hasn't gotten all the way around to this yet. Okay, so this isn't negative. This is positive, this wire, relative to what you've done here, the pressure you've created here. And the same is true over here. This is definitely positive. We had this connected to the positive end of the battery. So this end is definitely positive. So we're definitely going to send the pressure here, because this is already low pressure. We have a high pressure here. The high pressure is going to go that way and that way. So obviously when these two pressures meet, they're going to just cancel, right? This one's finally going to pressurize up here, and it's going to basically say you can't send any extra pressure here. So when I'm at 4 volts and you're at 5 volts or whatever, you know, you still have a little more pressure, but as soon as I'm 5 volts, you can't send the pressure this way anymore, okay? It just ain't going to go. So any extra pressure has to go the other way. So it'll all start going that way, you know, the circuit. So it doesn't really reflect. It just ceases to be able to continue in that direction. And now everything gets 5 volts, 5 volts, 5 volts. It pressurizes everything on this side, is pressurized. And so now the current has no choice but to go the only place there's a low pressure, which is this side. So there's no, it goes down the wire, it reflects, it comes back. That never happens. See, the wave theory just doesn't work. So it creates obligations, mechanical obligations that just aren't in the system. You're not going to reflect. You're a pressure. You're just going to say, I'm a pressure. If there's high pressure on this side of you, you match. There's nothing. You can't possibly do anything. If there's 5 volts on the other side of you, you can't do anything. You're just going to say, I'm 5 volts. You're not going to do anything. You're just going to stop being anything new. You're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to share your pressure with anybody. If it's 5 pounds on each side of you, you're not sharing with anything anymore. And so the only place that's going to decide where it can share is going to be over here. It can't share with the 5. I can't take 5 plus 5 and come up with some new number, right? I can't average into some other new number. I can't change it any. So it has to go this way. So this is the reflecting point. So it just depends on, you know, in the Veritasium example, you know, where you have a battery. I'll draw the standard battery. And then you have a switch. Okay. All right. So you have a battery, and you have a switch, and then you have the light bulb. Well, if I change the positions, right? So now the switch, okay, is on that side. So now I charge up this negative, all right, on this side of the battery. So it's negative here, it's negative here. So this side of the light bulb gets negative. So that's kind of easy. But if I move the light bulb just over here, okay, then it'll take the speed of light to get here, all right, before I can even create any inductive space. That is, before I can send, the induction has to move across here to the light bulb, in the sense that it has to go this way and then this way. So I can keep lengthening the path by just moving the switch further down the wire. And I lengthen the path because this wire on the other side of the battery will not become negative. So I can eliminate the inductive effect merely by putting the light bulb a few meters down the wire. And now I won't inductively excite the light bulb. All right. So now we'll do the Faraday part and the, you know, where the difference between this idea that you're just sending, you're changing atoms in this wire, they're going to reflect the universe differently. That different reflection is going to cause effects on the things it hits, the extra light, so to speak. I push my hand towards you, that little extra light I'm hitting you with is going to affect the atoms in the wire, and they're going to duplicate the pressure that the was causing this. Okay, this symptom of pressure I pushed out because I had pressure. That symptom is going to be transferred at the speed of light. The other wire is going to sympathetically feel the extra pressure, and it's going to do exactly the same thing this one's doing, except it's going to be a fraction of the voltage, because it's a tiny fraction of the actual pressure. All right. There's a difference between that and the real three-dimensional pointing vector thing. Okay, so I'll get to that. All right, so there are three weird electrical type phenomena. The first one would be wires, DC current. All right, and if you pump a lot of it into wires, you magnetize them essentially. And the weird thing is, when the current's going in the same direction, okay, so they seem polarized the same way, they're essentially, north, south, north, south, the wires attract, which is totally unintuitive. You would say, well, why would they attract? They're the same, they're the same magnets facing same magnets. That should be repulsive, not attractive. And if I did the opposite, and I had one that was, I make the current go, I should make these arrows bigger. I mean, obviously, both of them are going in the same direction. So, and then if I make the wires and I have the electricity go in opposite directions, the current, they repel. When logically you say they should attract. So that's one phenomenon. Okay. The second one is Faraday's let's see the best way to draw it. All right, you have a magnet, all right, with north, south, and then you just have a wire, okay, and then the wire makes contact in a fluid so it can move. So the wire is just suspended, it can spin. And essentially what you're going to do is put electricity through the wire in one direction. You have the magnet in another orientation, and what it'll do, when you can make this connection between the positive and the negative voltage with the wire, so the wire will spin. It will rotate around this field. Now, I'd argue that what's really causing that isn't some idea that the field around a magnet is spinning, because it's not, okay? Or that there's any spinning happening or any rotation in any magnetic field. It just has to do with a gravity argument. The wire is creating a magnetic field that's fine, trying to find a place that's comfortable, and there is no place that's comfortable. So it just keeps trying, okay, it keeps bouncing around, and it bounces around in a specific direction. So that's the point. It goes this way, okay, if I have north-south, and if I flip it to south-north, then it spins this way. And that's essentially the right-hand rule. So it's just basically telling you that there's an orientation between these magnetic fields and the electricity, and that they're intimately connected in the sense that you reverse one, you have to reverse the other, blah, blah, blah. And then the other one is my favorite in the sense that it's really neat. You just can't really, there's no intuitive thing that pops into your head and says, oh, wow, I understand why that happens. So I have a wire in between two magnets. And again, I have to use DC current. I have to use a lot of it so I can magnetize essentially the copper in the wire, or whatever, the material in the wire. So you need a lot of voltage going through it, okay, to create a magnet. You're trying to magnetize as many atoms. You're trying to polarize as many atoms in the conductor as possible to make it as strong a magnet as you can. So you use a lot of amperage, low voltage, high amperage. You want to use up all the atoms. You want all the atoms to be moving electricity. So you don't need a lot of voltage. You just need a lot of every single atom is involved in the process. So a lot of electrons moving slowly would be an analogy, I would argue. So I put the current in going through, the tail of the arrow would be what you'd see. So if I have an X here, that means it's going into, right? And if it's coming out, it's just a point because I'm seeing the tip of the arrow. But anyway, depending on which way you put the current through, the wire jumps out or it jumps in. Up or it jumps down. So again, it's a three-dimensional argument, right? There's a dimension, the current's going this way, the magnetic field's this way, and you're just saying what happens in the third dimension. So that's my argument, that this is really just about the three dimensions. And the fact is that the atom, as I'm trying to point out, when you polarize an atom, you're not polarizing it in one dimension. You're polarizing it in all three dimensions, because the polarization, how magnetic it appears, really just has to do with the distance between the electrons and the proton. So again, this, let's say this distance, okay, would be, well, let's put it in front of my face. So I have to go a distance away where my hand is half my face. Then you could say I look neutral. Because half of me is red, let's say my hand was red and my face was blue. Half of me is red and half of me is blue. But as I move the electron out, then I'm all blue. And if I move the electron even closer, theoretically, I can't move my hand, I can't make my hand small enough by moving it really close, I become very red. Okay, so if I move the electron really close to the nucleus of the atom, then the atom looks very red. And if I move closer to the atom and I get close to the electron, I can't even see the nucleus anymore. So that's the concept, I would say, is behind this. And so you have to understand that what you're really doing is, so imagine there's a third dimension here. Okay, so there's this dimension, and then there's this other third dimension in here, okay, where the electrons are arranged. And what you're basically saying is I've moved the nucleus to a position relative to the electron. So if I moved it here, you could see that from angles this way and this way, okay, I have created a very negative atom. And from this direction, it's very positive. So, let's see how to better say that. I'm just saying as you change the shape of the atom, by changing how much pressure is between individual electrons, you change what it looks like in different dimensions. And I guess the argument would be is that if I change the shape, say the shape was perfectly spherical, and I change the shape to this shape, you can understand that that shape means it's less thickness here, which means it looks more north, let's say. Okay, so it looks more south this way, it looks more north this way. Now, if I'm pumping electricity into it and I force this to look more north because I'm also pushing electricity into it, you can understand that that means I couldn't spread in this dimension. So when I squish this way or I lengthen this way, if I'm already putting electricity in and doing something to force it to be a certain shape, that means it can't expand this way. So if I'm pressurizing it, but I can't expand this way and this way, well, then my only choice would be to expand this way and this way into that third dimension. That's the sort of argument. So once you've decided that two dimensions are uneven, okay, say the nucleus is there in that dimension and it's theoretically moved over here in this dimension, so it's slanted in two of the dimensions, the argument would be is the third dimension has to compensate for that by being slanted in the other direction. So it can't be slanted where all the electrons get closer. It has to be slanted in a direction where all the electrons have more balance in their pressure. So as you pressurize two of the dimensions, the ones on the same plane, right, the ones that this way and this way are on the same flat plane, okay, both dimensions are on the same plane, you can do this. Once you do that and you create your little x way over here, the third dimension has to compensate for that by polarizing by a right-hand rule. So the rule is there's, see, this is where it gets complicated. There's three real dimensions, right? Up, down, forward, back, left, right. But there's really six sub-dimensions, right? Each dimension has two sides to it. So, you know, there's up and there's down. There's left, there's right. There's forward, there's back. And what we're really saying is the right-hand rule is basically saying it's happening in those six sub-dimensions of the three dimensions. So instead of going left, it goes right. Now, I don't have a reason for right versus left. I'm just saying that that's what it's made out of. That because of the, you know, you have to think in three dimensions to model this, so it's not that simple. You know, so you're trying to model what would be the reason why. So the idea is if it's left and it's up, it has to go backward, not forward. Because forward would be, it's not on the same plane as left and right. You get what I'm saying? I mean, left, if you do left and you do backward, you really only have one choice, okay, in terms of being complementary with your third dimension, is that you have to go, okay, up instead of down. So that's all I'm trying to get to. But that's the reason why there's a right-hand rule. Now, again, I'll just say in the induction argument, it's really not relevant because all you really have to know about is two-dimensional function in the sense that there's current going this way and there's a field effect going out. So if you just think of current as being an expansion of the wire, okay, pressure makes the wire fatter. The reflections don't happen where they would have happened. Instead, they happen sooner. Okay. And because you're getting closer, technically, there's more of them, but that's a tiny fraction. But the fact is you're compressing the rate at which the reflections get to the other guy. I've accelerated when they get to you by pushing out. And that is the inductive current. All right. That's the stuff, that's the force that has the capacity to induce an effect. So if we just sat here and imagined that the sun automatically expanded to twice its size, that would send a burst of photons to us, right? A gigantic burst of photons in a very short period of time while the sun expanded. As soon as it expanded, yes, it's a little bit bigger, but it wouldn't matter. Yeah, it wouldn't matter that much because it's so far away. Let me think how to say that. I mean, it obviously would matter that the sun's twice as big, so you're still going to get more light because the sun's a bad example because it's not about reflections. Because if it was just about reflected energy, then it would be a much, you wouldn't be as afraid of the sun getting twice as big. It's like Saturn getting twice as big. The reflected light wouldn't be any big deal, the amount of extra. But the fact is when it's getting bigger, that is a big deal. So when it is actually in the process of getting bigger, that's when it's collecting. That is, every frequency that hits it, it's increasing that frequency. So if if some energy is coming at it at a certain frequency, and that when we associate frequency with energy, it's obviously blue shifting because you're accelerating the time interval between the frequency by moving towards it, by moving into the frequency. You're going to increase the frequency, which means you've effectively increased the energy of that bit of momentum. All right, so that's probably enough of a premise. Back to some of the videos. So we'll go through some of this stuff. But again, I'm just saying in this context, I really don't think the pointing vector is relevant. He's sort of going to say that in the end. He's going to say all this talk about the pointing vector doesn't really work because if you really do it, it doesn't fit. Okay? It doesn't fit exactly what's happening. So, and I'm just pointing out that the pointing vector is real and it's probably a part of it applies to what wires are doing, but again, they're still not getting the fact that the wire is essentially creating a negative with two positives on either side. It's creating a current going in both directions.
Looking at meaning circuits without any inductors or transformers, the change in the magnetic field should be negligible, meaning we can ignore Faraday's law.
See, I don't think that would be rational to ignore it. It's just understanding it in context. And I don't know why he's putting an X through an inductor, because basically this is just about inducting. That's all the whole concept is about how do inductors, what are they affected by? Are they being affected by a force that the wire is creating, or is it a symptom of what the wire is doing? An environmental symptom. It's not the energy. Again, if I increase the size of Saturn, the energy you're going to get from Saturn isn't going to have anything to do with Saturn. It's going to have to do with how much light it's reflecting.
The other two equations are Ampere's circuit law and the work energy law for charged particles. This last equation states that the rate of work done on a collection of particles is given by the dot product of the electric field and the current density.
So this is just getting to the fact that each one of these dimensions has a different property, okay? And depending on how the dimensions are oriented, the interesting property is two of the dimensions have a sympathy with each other. They're on the same plane, and that third dimension is odd. And any one of the dimensions can be the odd dimension in any circumstance.
And if you wave away all the fancy vector calculus notation, you end up with power equals voltage times current, which was...
So this really isn't... I mean, he's gone so rudimentary that this really doesn't have... That doesn't tell you anything about the fact that you're polarizing atoms. That's what electricity is you're caused a polarization in the atoms. And so the voltage times the current is just telling you, that it's all about how much voltage is how fat, I shouldn't use the word fat, how big your football players are, and the current is telling you how many do you have. It's a force coming to get you, okay, and the force is made up of elements. You're just saying I can either make the elements, the bowling balls, really big, or I can have lots of them, okay? So current is lots of bowling balls. Velocity is big size, so I can have one big giant bowling ball roll over your house, or you can have 5,000 little ones roll over your house, and it all just adds up like momentum. We're really just saying mass times velocity.
It's the equation we just derived in the process of explaining circuits with the traditional model. And since pointing used as his starting point our fundamental equation from earlier, we see...
See, this is how circular it is. He's talking about a starting point that's really the same as the finishing point. He just circularly took it from the starting point, which is understanding you just have amperage in a wire, you have wattage. And you're just really saying, you're using the word power and the word force and the word, and they're all the same thing. So you can't have a final answer of, you know, force equals V times I. Well, yeah, it started that way. It didn't finish that way. That was true from the beginning.
See that the traditional model and the pointing vector aren't rival explanations. Instead, the pointing vector is the direct descendant of the traditional model. Therefore,
so again, it's a direct descendant in a very curious way, because again, it sort of violates some of the rules that seem intuitive. So again, you know, the DC current going the same way, creating attraction. Shouldn't do that.
Or if you use the pointing vector to analyze energy flow through a circuit, all you're doing is repackaging the power equation in a way that hides the current term. Let's see how it does that.
So this, I would argue, it doesn't really show how anything's hidden, and it, you know, it wasn't much to follow along here.
Returning to our example circuit, we know that energy is flowing from the battery on the left to the resistor on the right.
So this is sort of drawn sideways to every traditional way it's been drawn. So Veritasium obviously drew it the opposite way. Battery down here, light bulb over here. And technically this is still the same argument, but you're trying to say that it's a very short distance between the two wires and a very long distance to go all the way around to get to the light bulb. So taking the wire route is longer. So he's drawn it kind of intuitively backwards, because now it looks like it's a very short route just to take the wire route to get here. It's just as short. So he's taken all the length out of the travel time. So it's a little bit deceptive.
Right. We also know that the battery pumps electrons from the positive wire to the negative wire, and that the resistor allows them to flow back in the other direction. Therefore, the electrons must everywhere be flowing in a counterclockwise direction. This leads us to notice that on the negative wire, the energy flow...
So the pressure is moving in that direction. We know that the electrons are barely moving. They're jiggling a little. They're doing this little thing, little movement.
So matches the electron flow, whereas on the positive wire, energy flows in the opposite direction as the electrons.
Okay, so energy flow is just silly talk, frankly. So the pressure and the voltage and the current both move in the same direction. You're just moving the pressure, and you can't separate those two functions. There's no current. Okay, current is just telling you how much of the voltage the pressure is moving, and it has to move in the same direction as the pressure. You can't move the pressure like you have 5 volts here, you have 5 pounds here, you have 0 pounds of pressure over here. You're going to move the 5 over here. The current and the voltage are moving in the same direction.
And this is true no matter how we orient the circuit. So we conclude that...
All right, so but obviously how you orient this diagram will give you an idea that it's a much shorter distance between the battery and the resistor than there is distance between going all the way around by the wires.
If you want to use traditional circuit theory to determine the energy flow around a conductor, you need to know the voltage of the wire and the electron flow direction. Now let's see how you determine
it. All right, so right there you're just kind of done. You know, the electron flow direction just has to do with the fact that, again, Maxwell's equations are 200 years old, and it's, in my opinion, they've left Benjamin Franklin's wrong guess at positive and negative in the equation, and it's just backwards. It's just plainly wrong, okay? It's an increase in electrons is what's causing the effect, and it should be understood as that's the positive, that's the excess of pressure. And to have it oppositely labeled forces your equations to put signs in all the wrong directions. And that, you know, that's how you get current going the wrong way, is to fix this brokenness where you're calling an increase in pressure a decrease in pressure.
Energy flow using pointing vectors. The first step is to draw in the electric field lines. As stated earlier,
I mean, somebody, Maxwell, Blackwell, Jaxwell, ought to just redo the equations conceding, okay, that Benjamin Franklin was wrong. Just redo the assignment, and then you'll find that velocity, okay, the voltage, the electrical potential and the current have to travel in the same direction.
Electric field lines point away from areas of positive charge and towards areas of negative charge.
Okay, so it really doesn't, they're not doing that. So let's just understand, that's only if you use a negative test jumper. But if I just change the color of the jumper, I get exactly the opposite effect. So this isn't some standard idea that something is moving from one into the other. It's not doing that. But clearly the electrons are moving from positive pressure to negative pressure. So they're moving from high pressure to low pressure, but they're not jumping from one charge to another. That's a deception.
So that part is easy. To draw in the magnetic field lines, we need Ampere's law, which states that a magnetic field will form around any current carrying wire in the direction given by...
So this is essentially the motor force in a different form. So the compass and needles are all arranging in one way with a DC current going through the wire. But the fact is the compass needles, if they were really ultra light, wouldn't start spinning. They wouldn't do that, okay? So there's no direction in this field. The field is just saying that there's a magnetic bias, and say I have a pattern dot dash dot dash. I can go to some place where the dash is in the middle, and then I have dash and I have a dot on either side of it. So I have sort of an imbalance, right? I have one dash and I have two dots if I take a hunk of three of them. So when I take a hunk of that section, depending on who's in the middle, it'll have a bias in that direction. So essentially I'm saying this is just a bias, that because of the way of what's taking place, it's a very weak magnetic field, and the fact is that it's just really basically saying the compass needles are seeing the fact there's a tiny bit more north going one way than there is south going the other way because it's a north in the middle. You can imagine I could have a dot in the middle and I could have two dots on the outside where I cut the section. And then I'd end up with a bias that was three higher than the number of dashes.
By the rotational right-hand rule. Of course, thanks to Ben Franklin.
So I guess the filings that were in the other drawing, you can understand the filings aren't moving. They're just finding a place where there's a balance in the field, where they're being pushed in one direction as much as they're pushed in the other.
We are stuck with an electric current defined as opposite the direction of the flow of electrons.
Right, so he's conceding that, yes, Benjamin Franklin made a bad guess, and they never fixed the bad guess. And isn't this really, it's already a kind of complicated subject, but it makes it almost impossibly complicated when you have to deal with this fact that you're calling high pressure low pressure in the middle of your conversation. You're supposed to know that, when I say low pressure, I mean high pressure. Well, yeah, but later when I say high pressure, I mean high pressure. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Normally this is no big deal, but since this video has been
using... I think it's always, frankly, a big deal in the sense that I think it really breaks any intuition being useful here. I mean, there's no way to become... There's so many catches, it just makes it all just memorize the math and don't ever understand the math.
Electron flow thus far, I decided to continue the practice with Ampere's law. Therefore, instead of pointing the thumb of your right hand in the direction of positive current, we shall instead point the thumb of our left hand in the direction of electron flow. Or, if that hurts your brain, then...
Yeah, of course it hurts my brain. What's the point? You just look, there's clearly a relevancy. That's all you need to know, is that there's clearly a connection between up and counterclockwise and down and clockwise. So that would be the thing to understand, or vice versa.
Continue using the right hand rule and just make sure that you convert from the
left. Again, nothing's moving counterclockwise. You're just saying that if you were to describe the condition of the clock numbers on the clock, that's what they look like they're doing. The compass needle says so. But nothing's moving. There's no hands on the clock moving.
Electron flow to conventional current flow for these next examples. So with our left-hand rule, we can draw in the magnetic field lines as well. Lastly, we use the cross product right-hand.
So those field lines aren't the lines of force, and I would argue the lines of force are radially shooting out of the wire, they're hitting the other wire. Field lines aren't really relevant, it's how much force you're getting hit with, in what condition it's in, and that's deciding how much you're going to induce an effect in the other wire.
And rule to determine the direction of the pointing vector.
So it's really just three dimensions you just drew there. All right, he had forward, back, left, right, up, down. Three-dimensional universe, the polarization of atoms happens in three dimensions. That's why this is relevant. That's why this exists. It's because atoms are a three-dimensional object, and when they polarize in all three dimensions differently.
Sure. And with the pointing vectors added, we notice something interesting.
See, I could argue this is just a... I'll just briefly get to it. I would theorize, okay, that obviously the arrangement of atoms really has to do with the nucleuses, is where the helium, nuclei are. And we know that helium nuclei, you can throw them in space and they'll keep going. They're the things that can overcome drag. They're the motor. So if you said that inside of every atom, its motor is its neutrons and the orientation of its neutrons, you could almost argue that the right-hand rule is really just telling you that I've polarized the atom in such a way that the neutrons only have one choice in how they arrange. And once all the neutrons, that are, say the neutrons are the piece that's moving, so the neutrons are all moving in different directions inside the atom. And if I start to make the neutrons all move in the same direction, then the thing has to move, because the neutrons are the motor. I think that's, that's like a 70% hypothesis. I think the neutrons being pulled, they are dipoles. They're an electron and a proton. Where they're pointing is going to decide where something moves. So as you start turning the neutrons, that's when you force the wire to jump out of the magnets. That's the source of the motor force, is you've polarized the atoms, and by polarizing the atoms, you've polarized, in terms of their orientation, the neutrons. And now you're going to move the atoms. The difference between moving electrons, that's electricity, moving electrons. Moving whole atoms, that's when electricity becomes, physical momentum in our universe.
On the negative branch of the circuit, the pointing vector points in the same direction as the flow of electrons, regardless of how we orient the wire. And on the positive branch, the pointing vector points in the direction opposite to the flow of electrons. So we find that even...
So again, it's just recognizing that there's polarization in three dimensions, and frankly, atoms polarize in three dimensions, and that's all you're really... I think that's the rudimentary. That's why there is this orientation, is because there's a physical requirement that if you've polarized something in two dimensions, the third dimension isn't going to have a choice. It has to polarize also.
Though the pointing vector analysis uses a different set of inputs, it returns the same answer as the traditional analysis about the connection between the flow of electrons and energy flow direction. Of course, this makes sense when you realize that wire voltage and electric field direction are basically synonyms, and that the magnetic field is determined by the electron flow.
All right, so, all of this is really quite, I don't know who's getting it and who's not getting it, but I would counter it by pointing out that this presupposes that when you're inducing this pressure, that it's a polarized pressure, and it's not. It'll be polarized because the conductor isn't pressurized. And the fact is that when I push the negative in, I'm going to pressurize a portion of a wire, induce current, and the current is physically going to be in both directions. It's actually going to be a current in both directions because you're creating the dipole, the negative dipole, the high-pressure dipole, you've inserted, you have a strip of positive, of south pole magnet, and you're going to insert the north pole. Well, now you have a magnet this way, and you have a magnet that way. Okay, you could dissect, you know, bisect the north you stuck in there, and you'd have two batteries.
So what appears to be two different methods to analyze the circuit turns out to be the same method, with the magnetic field direction serving as a proxy for the electron flow. We can perform a similar analysis on the battery and resistor. These components serve as junctions between different voltages, meaning that the...
So here, I mean, he's kind of... He ought to just be saying, look, the Veritasium subject really is about induction in a wire. It's not induction into the resistor. The resistor is a replacement for the light bulb. But we can't get any current to the light bulb if we don't have any antenna to receive the induced current in the wire. So you have to concede there has to be antennas here. And he's just taking that concept out, which I think, again, breaks the continuity to what he's really arguing against, in my opinion. But fine, whatever.
Electric field lines near these components are parallel to the wire. As we learned earlier, power sources add energy to electric fields by pumping electrons from areas of positive voltage to areas of negative voltage, whereas power sinks remove energy from...
Well, we're really just pushing electrons from places where electrons are under high pressure to places where they're under low pressure, and that's all that's happening here. There's nothing else, okay? So there's no... There's just high pressure in a wire, or there's some lesser pressure in a wire. There's no such thing as anything other than that. It's just a relative difference, higher versus lower. There's no real negative. There's just an arbitrary ground where we say this is where we are. This is our state of how much pressure. We're under 50 pounds of pressure. Yes, you can be negative 5 million versus my 50, or you can be way above my 50. It's just a relative position, a relative amount of pressure. But there's just pressure. A lot of it or none of it. We can't have none of it. That's the catch.
From fields by allowing electrons to flow from negative voltage to positive voltage. But in addition to determining if a component adds or removes energy from a circuit, these different electron flows also determine the direction of the magnetic field around each component. So, using our right-hand rule, we find the components which add energy to a circuit have a pointing vector that points outwards, while components that remove energy from a circuit have a pointing vector that points inwards.
I think it's a mistake to say remove and whatever, but okay, fine. The pressure is a real thing. It's just as meaningful. There's not a, you know, a positive pressure and a negative pressure or a, you know, whatever. Is there anything I need to say on this? So again, he's showing it as rotation, but it's not really rotation, it's just orientation. It's just how compass needles will see the magnetic field. So again, you're seeing the field, and you're going to see it as a dot, with, you know, a dash with two dots on either side, or you're going to see it with a dot with two dashes on either side. You're either going to see a blue-ish magnet or a reddish magnet. You know, that's sort of the argument. It's not about spinning. It's just about the fact that at your position, it's decidedly, you know, it's polarized in a direction.
So again, it may initially appear as if the traditional and pointing methods are distinct approaches for analyzing circuits. But because voltage and electric field directions are synonyms, and because electron movement determines magnetic field direction, the two approaches end up being quite similar and return the same results.
I don't know. Yeah, I can paraphrase this by saying, look, yeah, we're all accepting that there's this connection between the flow of the electricity and the orientation of its magnetic field. Okay, yes, there's a rule. This shouldn't be argued. But whether that rule is capable of what it's inducing in the other wire is the key argument. I'm just saying that that's already a given. It's going to induce what it's doing. If the wire got bigger, it's creating more pressure. If the wire got smaller, it's creating less pressure in the other wire. That's what it's actually physically doing. it's going to create a magnetic field that's going to be exactly opposite to the one that produced it. Opposing, not opposite, sorry, opposing, which means it's going to be the same. It's going to be the same field.
So if these two methods are really the same method, is one better suited for introducing students to the idea of electricity? Because in his video, it did seem like Derek was pushing for the pointing-based explanation to be taught as the introductory model.
No, what he's arguing is that somehow all of this field stuff, okay, is what it's about when it's really about the pressure in the wire. And yes, there's a tiny symptom. The wire has a symptom that when it gets bigger, it causes a little tiny signal to go out into the universe, okay, indicating it moved. Just, again, all I have to do is move my hand like this, and technically I've sent a signal to Alpha Centauri, okay? I've done it. I've changed the number of photonic bits that are going to hit things billions of light years away. I've changed it by doing this, by changing my profile, by changing my shape. I change the energy that's reflecting off of me, and I hit different objects in space with that energy. It's just a fact. That's all this is about. But it's a tiny effect. It's a tiny amount of my energy is in the reflecting I'm doing.
And it was that inference that I found to be the most strange, because there are several problems associated with learning the pointing-based explanation first. First of all, as we've already seen, the derivation of the pointing vector starts with the fact that power equals voltage times current, along with Ampere's law.
I don't think it starts there. I just don't see how you turn the wattage equation, how that tells you anything about these inductive effects and in what way you're going to cause those effects. So I don't think it explains the motor force or any other force. So, any other thing we call a force, any other change. I mean, it's just too simple. You can't get there. You can't get anywhere this complicated from, voltage times current. It's not telling you enough.
So if you wanted to understand why the pointing vector works, you'd have to first learn those two equations, along with about a semester's worth of vector calculus. And if you were going to learn about P equals VI, then you'll probably end up learning the standard explanation in the process. So instead of trying to rush into a discussion of pointing vectors,
I don't even know what the standard explanation would be, in a sense, beyond just recognizing the fact that, again, I can make one big snowball and throw it at you, or I can make 100 littler ones and throw them at you. But it's really just going to be a momentum argument. I have a certain amount of energy. I can convert it into different sized objects and different numbers of objects, but it's always just going to calculate out to be the same thing. Okay, all there is the voltage and the current. All there is the amps and the volts, and that's your power. That's your watt. That's what all you have in the end. It's all a momentum argument. Again, it's just momentum. P is the velocity and I is the mass. How many atoms have you involved, and how involved are they?
Why not just take the time to make sure students thoroughly learn the standard model?
Even to say the word of standard model, he just means the standard model of voltage and current and wattage, I guess. But this isn't really that, okay? I mean, the fact that there's positive and negative charges in the universe, and the fact, again, that he's, it's just these flow arrows are such a lie. There's no flowing from one to the other. Nothing's flowing.
There are other problems associated with switching to a pointing vector-based teaching approach. For example, let's say you found a copper box, drilled some holes in it, and then took the light bulb circuit and placed half of it in the box. Would the circuit still work? Now,
okay, so of course it wouldn't work, because now he's created a Faraday cage. So he's preventing the induction, the effects. He's just fundamentally blocking the photons, right? I mean, the photons coming from the wire expanding. Oh, the wire expanded. It got bigger. The field changed. Well, it doesn't matter because the field hit the copper box, okay? So it's gone. So he could have just used a Faraday cage, and now you've broken induction, so the light bulb will not light because the other wire will not have the current induced in it. But you need one hell of a big copper box in this case. I suppose if you just put... So you can't just put the light bulb in the box. He has to put the antenna in the box. So if the antenna is outside the box, you know, the transmitting line is outside the box, well, then it's still going to get the induced current, and so it's still going to get the electricity, and it goes into the box. So if you have cables going out of the box to an antenna, well, then you can't, the Faraday cage will fail. But yes, if you put the substance of the conductor inside the box with the light bulb will not have any induced current.
Someone taught with the traditional explanation of circuits would guess that, yeah, the circuit would still function fine. After all, there is still a voltage difference between the two wires, and current is still flowing through the circuit, so power should still be delivered to the bulb. But that answer may not be as obvious to someone taught with the pointing explanation. After all, electric fields don't...
Well, any idiot who would think that... Well, again, the way he drew it is still wrong because it's still just about the time it takes to get down the wire where the antennas are. So it's just about how where the antennas are. If you leave any of the antenna outside the box, the light bulb will light through induction first. And clearly, if you're just going through the wire, you're just going to go through the wire. The wire isn't going to be bothered at all by the box. The voltage in the wire is immune to your copper box.
It exists inside conductors. And since the pointing vector is proportional to the strength of the electric field, it would be reasonable to assume that the pointing vector would also be blocked by the box, meaning the light should turn off. Of course, our cars are filled with wires running through holes in conductive sheet metal, and yet my lights still turn on just fine. Therefore...
Right, but the argument is there's... If Veritasium's just playing a field game, okay? There's a field on the outside of the wire, and there's obviously a field in the wire in the sense that there is pressure between the electrons, and that's a field, you could argue. But obviously, as everybody tries to understand electrons, we're just understanding them as a representation of pressure. And if you're going to technically say, well, it's a field that's pushing them, well, yeah, it's a technically there's a field pushing the electrons, but it's really, that's not the key. The key is that the electron's presence, its existence, is what is going to increase the pressure. Without its existence, there is no extra pressure. You have to push the electron into, you have to move it, okay, to create the extra pressure.
This box probably won't block energy flow either. To see why, let's look at a cross-section view of the circuit without the box. As we can see, an electric field fills the space between the positive and negative wires. And since the pointing vector is proportional to the electric field, it must also fill this space. But now let's run the wires through the holes in the copper box. When the wires are first placed in the box, the electric field passes through the copper. The electric field interacts with the electrons in the copper.
All right, let's understand. So this, I would just say this is so obvious in the sense you know that what the cable is doing, okay, it doesn't matter what the outside world is doing. It doesn't care. It's not really important, you know, unless you do something very radical to the environment, like an earthquake or something. So it's just doing its thing, and it's creating this effect. This, it's like a gas going through a gas pipe, and you could argue it's making sound. The making of sound as the gas goes through the pipe and creates a little bit of sound and vibrates the metal and, you know, vibrates the ground a tiny little bit. That little effect is not going to have anything to do with the gas going through the line. Not going to change it any. So what I'm reflecting, the light, the photons I'm reflecting are not even a second thought, not even a 15th, not even a 1 millionth thought of my existence. I don't sit there and go outside and say, gee, I'm going to reflect more photons and it's going to be a terrible burden. Yeah, it's irrelevant, but it's still a real side effect. All right, so this is probably enough, and we'll try the last bit, but maybe I'll just jump ahead of this pointing vector, the rest of this. Let me just skip it here, and then I'll feel better because I already skipped it.
Harry, just might catch fire. But power would be prevented from reaching the light bulb, so...
Right, this is because now you have... Now he doesn't have holes in the conductor, so you're just short-circuiting the wire into the copper box. So obviously, yes, if you short the wire into the Faraday cage becomes a conductor, and it will, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, that's just too obvious, almost. I mean, that's sort of... All this technical crap for such an obviously... You know, it's like you can't mix all these technical arguments and then make an argument where, here, do I have to explain this to you too? If I have a bucket with water over your head and the bucket tips, you know, will the water hit you in the head? Yeah. All right, so maybe we'll come back to this point.
This answer ignores the nature of the pointing vector.
Okay, so I don't know, maybe that's the place to come back. I don't know. We'll decide later. Somewhere in there. Anyway, enough said. So, yeah, that's enough. All right, so, till the next time and such, this has been at draftphysics.com, debatephysics.com also, but nobody can engage in the conversation where they... See, I said some things, you know, about electricity. I made some assertions about how it functions. Somebody could show some evidence or make a reasoned logic argument or draw a different picture and explain how, no, it can't be that way. But nobody can do that. So far, we can't find anybody willing to do any of that. All right. So, till then, you know, such.